This is Writer's Cast, a podcast about books and authors. I'm your host, David Wilk. Today I'm interviewing an author named Tony Horwitz, the author of A Voyage Long and Strange, with a subtitle, On the Trail of Vikings, Conquistadors, Lost Colonists, and Other Adventurers in Early America. Hi, Tony.
Hi. Thanks for having me.
Oh, it's great to have you. What prompted me to read your book was that I saw you at the Martha's Vineyard Book Festival this summer, and I heard you talking about this book, and I knew I was going to read it as soon as I heard you talking, because this is it's an interest of mine for a long time. And maybe you can talk a little bit about the genesis of this story, which is you traveling around America in the footsteps of early explorers and settlers. But what got you to the, and it's in the book, but maybe you can talk a little bit about how you started.
Yeah, I think the book really began with the discovery of my own ignorance. I'm someone who's thought of himself as a history nerd since early childhood, but on a visit to Plymouth Rock, I realized basically that I knew nothing about what happened here in America, particularly between Europeans and natives, in the period before the Thanksgiving story, which is where we tend to begin, the American narrative. So really I set out to fill that gap of pre-1620 North America.
Well, and it's a pretty extensive history. There's a lot. I mean, I know you went to where the Vikings, I guess that was Labrador or Newfoundland. Newfoundland. Some early Vikings sites there. But what I thought was interesting is you spent a lot of time in the book talking about the places you were with people who were there. I mean, the style of the book is very interesting because it's not classical history in the sense of you went to the places in order to talk about the history. You included a kind of narrative along with the history about what people are like today and how they've absorbed that history in the places where they live.
Right. Well, I mean, history is really two things. One, it's what happened way back when, as best we can establish it. And two, it's how we remember those events and the stories we tell about them. And I'm really interested in both. So I weave between past and present, try and tell the story of what happened, but also visit in the present. I'm a journalist by training and have written about my travels elsewhere. I like to go to the places where history happened, see what's there now, and as you said, try and understand how we remember and more often misremember our past and why that is.
Well, and of course, in some of the, I guess some of the high points for me, it may not be in order of your travel, but in places where the early contact between Europeans and Native Americans took place, where the history was not so good, let's say, for the people who are already here. You cover a lot of the discussion, let's say, in the Southwest about, the brutalization of some of the Spanish explorers. But then there are people in New Mexico, for example, who celebrate the Spanish.
Right.
So there's a lot of kind of interesting, many sides to the story.
Yeah, well, I would say New Mexico, of all the places I went, was probably the place where this history, which is, a long time ago, most of it 400 and 500 years ago, is most vivid because the players or their descendants are still on the premises. You have the Pueblo Indians in Zuni and other Pueblos living right where they were when the Spanish first encountered them in the early 16th century. And you have the descendants of those early Spanish conquistadors and later pioneers. and they still live cheek by jowl there in the mesas and arid backcountry of northern New Mexico and western New Mexico. So you have this fascinating situation where, as you said, neighbors really remember the same events very differently. And while Native Americans understandably remember the European arrival in very negative terms, the descendants of those first arrivals often celebrate them.
Well, and of course, it is unusual at least in North America, actually, North America, South America, and Central America, it's unusual for Native people to have retained the strength of their culture in the face of this waves of millions and millions of people from other places. And in New Mexico, I think that's probably the place where, as you say, the survival is the strongest. Mm-hmm. So that they've retained not only their culture but their memory mm-hmm. of what happened.
And also their own language and belief system. In many parts of the country, sadly, those Indians who weren't, basically run off their land or killed in warfare or by disease, the ones who did survive underwent, fairly forcible, not so much assimilation, but forced to lose their language and culture and the marks that really made them who they were. And many tribes are recapturing that today, but the Zuni are quite remarkable in having maintained that continuously over the centuries.
Right, and you mentioned, you talk about one of the issues that I think has been discussed now in kind of new historical discussions, and that is the question about disease mm-hmm. and epidemics prior to the arrival of the Europeans who wrote about North America, let's say. There were epidemics that, in a sense, effectively may have decimated or wiped out large numbers of Native American tribes.
Mm-hmm. So yeah, the effect is really catastrophic. By some estimates, in the first century of European Native contact, somewhere between 75% to 90% of Natives in America died from a host of diseases such as smallpox that they had no exposure to, no immunity to.
Right.
Just unimaginable devastation. I think it's a mistake, though, to look at the disease in isolation, because it was usually part of a package that included being pushed off their land, being slaughtered in battle, famine, other aspects that also weakened them and perhaps made them even more susceptible to these European diseases.
Right, but the interesting thing too is that there's the notion of disease as kind of letting some of the Europeans off the hook for what they did, because the native people were already weakened, and therefore kind of allowing the Europeans to feel like, well, this is virgin land, it's empty land. That was always that's one of the themes of mm-hmm. exploration and justification for conquest, essentially, was, well, there aren't either the people who are here are not people because they're not Christians, or there isn't anybody here. It's empty.
Yeah. Right. I mean, I think many Americans still kind of imagine this country when Europeans arrived as a virgin wilderness. It wasn't. The population of the Americas as a whole in, say, 1492 when Columbus arrived was probably larger than Europe. But also in the century really before the Pilgrims got here, that population declined catastrophically. So that, for instance, to take the Pilgrims as a vivid example of this, they arrive in Plymouth, and or what they what became Plymouth, and one reason they settle there is because there's been an epidemic shortly beforehand that's wiped out the coastal population. So they essentially find this ghost town with water and fields sowed with corn, a really a convenient place to settle, and also no one to oppose them. And that's really because of the waves of disease that preceded their arrival.
Yeah, and you touch upon, I mean, there's so many interesting things in this book. I mean, one of the things that struck me was how ill-prepared, particularly the British, seemingly ill-prepared to survive in this world that they found, and how many false starts there were in various settlements over the years. I mean, in fact, there are so many that you cover, you know, just in New England alone, or New England, and let's say New England to down to Virginia, many false starts. But of course, even before that, the Spanish came to America and the French came to America with some startling results, you know, where things didn't quite go the way they thought they would.
Right. Yeah, I mean, this isn't only a story of a sort of tragedy for Native people. The first Europeans, I mean, really, success was the exception, not the rule. This is a period of just constant sort of trial and error and failure. And the Europeans themselves succumbed to diseases, to famine, to infighting, to fighting with the natives. And you know the body count throughout this period is really high, and even the ones that do succeed ultimately come at an unbelievable cost. Jamestown, which is the first permanent English settlement, of the first 20,000 or so English to settle there in the early 1600s, about 75% of them died. And, you know, within a short time of their arrival. And, of course, the pilgrims, half of them die in that first winter in Plymouth. So the ones that do make it, really, it's really by the, you know, could easily have gone the other way.
Well, and it's, you know, and I think also of just if you try to imagine, you know, they sailing across the ocean in these little tiny boats. You know, I know this is sort of the romance of how we remember exploration, and we don't have a similar narrative for the other side, which would be the romance of, you know, what it was like to live in the Americas, both North and South and Central, you know, as a Native person. There, we don't have a similar narrative for them, but, you know, it was a different time, and it was very challenging for people who lived here to survive. But some of the stories are just incredible. You know, I knew about Cabeza de Vaca, and you know, I'd read his story a couple of different times. But I don't think I was. I learned a lot about Coronado, whose story is just incredible. I mean, you have some really intrepid. I mean, travelers that are beyond comprehension in their ability to persevere.
Absolutely. I mean, the Spanish, who are in some respects hard to like because of their kind of brutality to natives and their sort of mania for gold in particular, but also converting the Indians in a not particularly friendly way, are in another sense just inspire awe, I guess, is the best word, not necessarily admiration, but awe. For what they did, they would set off, as you said, very, very ill-prepared, and march for thousands of miles, Coronado all the way from central Mexico to central Kansas before he gives up in his search for gold, and Hernando de Soto, who arrives in Florida at roughly the same time, and he and his army march all the way to Texas, and you know, almost half of them die before they straggle back to the Gulf of Mexico and then set sail for Mexico. So these are really epic journeys, almost unparalleled in human history in some ways, given the trials they endured and how little they knew of the lands they were setting off to explore.
Right, and for most part, the Spanish seems to have recorded what they did, at least in some way. I mean, I think a lot of the British stories, you know, seem to be more fanciful and unreliable. Of course, what you have in many cases is people coming here and then going back to Europe to either celebrate their own accomplishments, to build themselves up, so for a variety of reasons, commercial and otherwise, or you have people trying to sell the Americas as a place to go, also for commercial reasons. So sometimes the stories they told might not be fully reliable.
Right. Well, I think it was, you know, for me, probably the most challenging part of writing this book is judging, you know, how much of this we can believe. And the Spanish in particular were brilliant record keepers. So we do have extensive reports on these journeys. We have court cases. We have other things. And I think you really just have to sort of cross-reference them and try and find the areas that, you know, where ideally you have more than one source or you have enough other information to give you the sense that it is reliable. And, you know, the English, some of them are also wonderful and I think mostly accurate writers, John Smith in particular. But I have to say my favorite writers are the French, just because they write with such a flair and sensitivity for both the people and the land that they encounter. And, you know, they write about the food and the wine and the women, you know, they're French, even then. So it really is part of the fun of this era is that you do have these different national personalities.
Well, I wanted to talk to you about the French, and because I think the, you know, I've read quite a number of early Jesuit. Mm-hmm. You know, I studied anthropology, and the Jesuits have tremendous, narratives about being in Canada and northern United States. But I did that probably of all the different. I mean, you couldn't obviously touch on everything that happened everywhere, but I think that if there is a sequel, it would be to ask, you know, to want you to talk more about, you know, and explore the French.
Yeah.
Because I think their history here is very interesting.
Absolutely. And it was in the sort of afternote to the book, I confess that, you know, I couldn't include everything. And I had originally planned to do quite an extensive chapter on Champlain and follow in his footsteps. But I left it for last, and frankly, you know, I'd been working on the book at that point for about 4.5 years, and there's a time when you just have to say, I'm going
to
wrap it up.
Well, you have
also,
to finish somewhere.
Yeah, I also knew that it's since come out that there was a major Champlain biography on the way by David Hackett Fisher, Champlain's Dreams. So I think for people who are interested in that, there's a more scholarly version of that story. But I was glad to be able to talk about the French in Florida, which I think is one of the least known episodes in our early history.
That's definitely true. Well, you know, in just thinking about books, you have an extensive reading list. You obviously did not just walking around or driving around to see things and do the research on the ground, but you read a tremendous number of books. Of the books you read, or even of books you didn't note in your bibliography, can you pick out a couple that you would recommend to people who, let's say they've read your book, mm-hmm. they've now become newly turned on to this period of American history? What would you recommend they read next?
Wow, I think the best thing is to go right back to the primary sources, and as much as possible, I tried to cite them in my book. And, you know, we have the advantage in the age of the Internet that some of these are quite easily accessible now. You don't have to go to an archive in Seville or, you know, London. I mentioned in the afternotes there's a website called American Journeys that I believe is the University of Wisconsin or the Wisconsin Historical Society that has a fabulous compendium of accounts by early explorers. So that's one sort of easy stop for a whole range of those. I think if I had to pick one author, it might be John Smith, and he wrote a number of books, and it's sort of hard to recommend one, perhaps a good anthology of his writing. He, a very vivid writer, I think a reliable one, and a writing style that's sort of familiar to us because he was a contemporary of Shakespeare. So the language is, you know, at times difficult, but it's also somehow familiar to us in a way that, say, the Spanish and the French accounts can be more challenging.
So the Spanish and French are a little bit more Renaissance in style. whereas the British, although except for the spelling, I love the spelling in the 17th century.
He was a very, John Smith is a very eccentric speller and wasn't fond of punctuation and long run-on sentences. So he can be challenging to read, but I think once you get used to his odd style, it's just fascinating. And his cultural references, again, because he's an English speaker, are, you know, perhaps easier for us. And so, you know, if I had to recommend one area I'd read, I would say John Smith.
And what about, it just, this is, again, probably personal to you, but what about the places that you went? Of all the places that you went, and you went, I mean, this was a vast journey, what place that you discovered, maybe a place you'd never been before, really stands out for you as a place that you enjoyed the most?
Yeah, well, it's a funny thing as a writer, or certainly the kind of thing I do. It's from a writing point of view, it's the worst places that are often the best to write about. You know, my kind of misery in the Dominican Republic and Newfoundland, and a couple places that, frankly, I'm not dying to get back to. I think we're sort of the most fun to visit as a writer. As a sort of traveler, as I mentioned, I think New Mexico is really the landscape and the history is perhaps easier to reach out and touch than just about anywhere else I went. A place called the Sky City of Acoma, a pueblo near Zuni, that's just remarkable on the top of a rock, basically. I would say, you know, the Southwest in general is the richest from a sort of historical tourism point of view.
Oh, it's a terrific book, and I really, you know, we didn't touch on some of the things that I thought were just amazing. You know, your intrepidness in being willing to go long, long distances, and as you mentioned in the Dominican, to, you know, to experience, you know, the culture with people who live there, and, you know, kind of enter other people's journeys, and then, you know, of course, live to tell about it. But your writing style is terrifically engaging. You know, your journalistic experience served you well.
Okay.
I enjoyed the book a lot and recommend it. Well, thanks, Tony Horwitz, for talking to me today about A Voyage Long and Strange. It's a wonderful book. I've enjoyed talking to you. This is David Wilk for Writer's Cast. Thank you very much.
Thanks for having me.
Take care.